I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone in our country has a voice. It's something that says not just where you come from, but who you are. Welcome to NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of podcasts and a celebration of the hosts in journalism who've always spoken truth to power. Our voices are as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, and stories should never be about us without us. Find NPR Black Stories, Black Truths on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, starting May 6th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's Francisco and my Francos?
This is Robert Evan.
Yeah.
Farting fuzz.
Yep, there we go. We introduced it.
Yeah.
It's not as big a name as Hitler. Like, I'm going to be honest with you. Not doesn't have the kind of star power. Like, if Hitler's like...
Cut.
Like Ben Affleck, right?
Yeah.
And we're doing like the Matt Damon of fascism today. Like,
he's just
not the same level.
Pretty... That is not accurate. You are completely wrong. You just like his tattoo. Come on.
I love his trashy, gigantic, fullback Phoenix tattoo.
That's pretty funny.
It's rad.
We got to think of somebody that's like a deep
Matt
cut.
Matt Damon is more famous than Ben Affleck.
That's nonsense.
Like, it's more like a Scottie Pippen. You know what I'm saying? Like
Scottie Pippen to Hitler's the Michael Jordan of fascism.
Yeah, this is like Scottie Pippen.
Better.
We're talking the Scottie Pippen. And like Scottie Pippen.
Yeah,
Francisco Franker.
MVP.
Yeah, he's a Francisco's underrated. You know, he's a good.
He's like,
not he's good. A, he's a monster.
He had
but
a shoe.
Quite
Scottie
a
Pippen had a shoe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Pippins. Like we're talking about like Franco's, which would be jackboots almost as tall as the Hitler jackboots and not quite as shiny.
Yeah, and cost
but still
less.
Jackboots. Yeah, and they're a little
but they
cheaper.
Still jackboots.
Yeah, for the fascist on a budget, you know?
So I think you just wanted to talk about the tattoo again.
I did. I always want to talk. And how
the tattoo's hilarious.
And how sad Ben Affleck looks every time he's captured in the wild. Just looks like he's been dying for the last 20 straight years,
when
and I'm here for
picks
it.
Him up
I
from
love
the
it.
Jack in the box.
Oh, it's incredible.
Oh,
he's just so miserable all the time.
It just feels like he spent so much time being attractive that he just got tired of it and was just like, oh my
you
God.
Know, speaking of fascism, you've heard of the Fuhrer principle, the idea that like a single man can embody the spirit of a people, which is, you know, what Hitler used to rise to power. I never believed in it until Ben Affleck, because Ben Affleck is the spiritual embodiment of Boston.
He really like,
is. He's perfect. Yeah.
He's really amazing. Boston. He really is.
Mm-hmm.
Like if the Southies weren't so damn racist, I would really like that area. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I hate the Celtics, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. All day.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the Celtics. But I know a bit about fascism. And fascism's a little bit different in every country. It's kind of like Skittles, you know?
Yeah.
Different flavors.
Chocolate and chips.
Yeah, mean, yeah.
Ketchup
yeah,
those, chips.
Yeah, milk chocolate as opposed to the dark. You know, this is part of why scholars and theorists have such a damnable time defining what fascism is in the first place.
Yeah.
There's a dictionary definition, right? There's going to be a dictionary definition in any dictionary you open. But it's not really useful, in part because a lot of dictionary definitions of fascism apply almost as well to, like, communist regimes, any authoritarian regime, which is, you know, there's some points there, which is that whenever you have a totalitarian system, similar bad things often do happen. But fascism is unique for a number of reasons, including its ability to subvert healthy democracies. And so when you have historians of fascism, people whose whole life is studying this thing, this amorphous thing that we're still kind of getting grips on, all of them kind of tend to have their own definitions of it. And often those definitions don't contrast. They're just different ways of kind of wording the same things. I tend to feel confident that Umberto Eco has done the best job of defining it in his essay on fascism. I'm a big fan of the way Eco talked about fascism. And I think that Eco would have named Trump as a fascist straight away, in part because in the mid-90s, when he wrote his essay on fascism, he predicted that the internet and like the way that it would allow people to spread messages and crowdsource activism would lead to the rise of a unique kind of fascist. And I think that Trump embodied that in a lot of ways. And I think Eco would have seen it right away. Now, on the other hand,
I think I may know where Echo's going. I haven't read the thing, but like I have this theory about the type of fascist that Trump is. But I'd love to hear what this guy says.
Yeah, I mean, Eco kind of outlined a number of different things that are when you have a mix of these things and sort of a constellation, that is what fascism is. So there's a mix of like, you know, popular resentment against the left, like a sense of machismo, of misogyny, a cult of action for action's sake, syncretism, the ability to like pull other things in and kind of attach them to itself, other like aspects of spirituality and whatnot. There were a bunch of different things that Eco noted as kind of key aspects of fascism. What were you saying?
No, because I was going to say, what was so interesting about like what I feel like what we're going to hear as history nerds for the next, 100 years about the unique, what Trump symbolizes, and it might just be a new type of fascism for the rest of our life, but just this fascism that doesn't have a foreseeable goal, like, except for just being in power. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what was so interesting to me about the uniqueness about Trump's fascism is like, yeah, but what's your end game here? Like, what are you doing? You know what I'm saying? Whereas, like, we knew what Mussolini was doing. We know what,
Hitler.
We knew, he did it. Like, we knew what you were doing. This was your goal. You know what I'm saying? And I'm just like, what are you doing, dude? You know?
His goal lack of a plan, right? TrumpSingles.com.
Yeah,
apparently
Trump's in,
that's selling one of the things that does, in schools and universities.
That does I think that did I think threw some people off is that he clearly didn't have as much of it. Like Mussolini, I do think is more similar to Trump than Hitler is in the kind of fascist that he was and in his goals. But Mussolini had a plan to like take and hold power. And I guess one of the things that's been revealed is that like Trump definitely wanted to take and hold power, but he did not have much of a plan. Not a plan.
Yeah, I was like, your goal is to reach a goal.
Your goal was like, just almost like, there's a lot to be said.
You just want to keep being right, I think, I'm like, about what? Yeah, anyway, let's go on.
It's interesting. And a number of, there are other scholars of fascism who took a lot longer to kind of decide that Trump fit their definition of fascism. I'm thinking about Robert Paxton here. And Paxton is a very well-respected scholar of fascism. He wrote a book called The Anatomy of Fascism that's a very good book. And he only felt comfortable declaring Trump a fascist after January 6th. And he was like, that was the line. Like, Paxton had been consistent. He's an authoritarian. There's fascist elements in what he does. But he didn't kind of name him a fascist until after the 6th. And I'm not slamming Paxton. I think there's a room for intellectual debate on this, and I understand kind of why he, like you said, Trump's a different kind of one, right? And where if fascism changes based on the country and based on the time period, and I do think kind of one of the things that Eco was sort of peering around the edges of when he was talking about how he thought we were going to see an internet-based fascism in the future was the idea that like another aspect of fascism, and he didn't define this as a key aspect of fascism, but I think that it is the fascist is the ability to find a way to utilize new media technology in a way that no one else understands yet, which Trump did, right? No other politician understood how to use social media in the way that Trump did when Trump came onto the scene.
Yeah.
It's a big part of his success. Yeah. Anyway, so there's a lot of debate over what is a fascist. And as a result of this debate, there's actually quite a lot of argument on whether or not the regime of Francisco Franco in Spain was truly fascist. And you'll find a lot of argument about this, about whether or not Franco was a fascist. There were fascists in Spain, absolutely. Whether or not Franco and his regime really accounts. And what's not up for debate is that many elements of the Spanish right leading up to and during the Spanish Civil War were fascists. And that fascist powers, Italy and Germany, intervened in that civil war because they saw what was happening there as a battle between fascism and socialism, largely. Yeah. And more to the point, whatever you can say about Franco himself, and we'll talk about him more in part two, the battle over Spain in the late 1930s absolutely ranks as the first open military conflict between fascism and democracy, and fascism and socialism too, right? Like all of that was kind of in the mix.
Yeah.
And on the Spanish side, the Republican side, you had like the Spanish Republic who were, you know, liberals, more or less, people who supported like a constitutional democracy, and you had anarchists and communists and socialists of varying kind of lesser strains, yeah. Trotskyists too, who were, yeah. It's a very complicated civil war. It's more like Syria than a lot of other conflicts because totally. There's so much going on, so many different kind of corners to it.
What's now, interesting, real quick, yeah. before you get into this, is like, you know, in a past life, I was like a history and social science, like high school teacher. And I went through the entire credentialing process all the way up to master's. And at no point in any of our California standards was it ever required to talk about this. And which is so interesting to me to when, especially when I'm trying to set up, you know, because since I wasn't a direct history teacher, I was more like a social science teacher, mm-hmm. trying to set up how cultures get where they get and like why it was so weird around World War II and why we got so like we was already itchy, why a lot of us was like, man, we really don't want to go over there. It's because I was like, well, because of the Spanish Civil War, like we kind of, you know, we was kind of going back and forth about sending troops over there. Like and the students were like, wait, what? And I'm like, yeah, Spain had a civil war. Like, yeah, this happened. Yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying? This was like, it was right before World War II. Like, this happened.
It
was like,
it was this whole big thing.
That was like, it's a big thing. And we were involved. Like, we almost, you know what I'm saying? But just like, that's like in no.
Thousands of Americans volunteered. Yeah.
Yes. And I'm like, it's not required to talk about. And I'm like, oh my God, you're missing a lot of the story if you don't understand why even World War II was so touchy for us.
Yeah.
And part of it was this. Anyway, go on.
One of the reasons people don't like to talk about this is that it's very complicated, and it is not as much of a cut and dried story as makes it easy to sort of summarize, right? Once the fighting starts, once the Civil War starts, it is a bit easier, but even then, it's a very fucking messy war.
Yeah.
And there are really shitty people on the good guys' side too, right? Like there's a lot of like very ugly stuff that happens because it's a war, you know? Uh-huh. The same is true of World War II. It's just been heavily whitewashed, and the Nazis were so fucking bad that it makes easier to make your side seem like the good dudes. Uh-huh. Now, in some ways, because of how complicated it is, and this whole episode is about the birth of Spanish fascism, and we're going to do some pretty deep history here. And in some ways, the story of how fascism evolves in Spain bears a lot less resemblance to what's happened in America than either of the two stories we've discussed so far. Mm-hmm. But while the similarities are a lot less direct, I actually think there's a lot here that's valuable because we're going to kind of lay out how this evolved over time and how the birth of fascism in Spain was woven into the birth of democracy itself. And I think that's a really important story. But we're going to need a lot of context. So Spain is unique, fairly unique among European nations in that it has not had a sense of nationalism for most of modern history. Not in nearly the same way that you got with England or with France or with Germany once, you know, 1870, whatever rolls around. The Spanish state does go back very far to 1478 when Ferdinand and Isabella, you know, the Columbus folks, right?
Yeah, when they decided to colonize all of South America.
Yeah. And before that, they were the ones like Spain. They kick out the Moors, you know, the Muslims who had kind of taken over a chunk of Iberia as a result of a counterattack. Anyway, they take back Spain for Christendom. That would be the way they would have framed it.
Yeah.
But they don't actually make a nation, not in any modern sense. Spain is a bunch of independent kingdoms. And those independent kingdoms, up until fairly recently, never really melded together. You've got the Aragonese, and you've got Catalans, and you've got the Basque. And they all have their... And there's more than that, right? I'm not going to pretend this is good. Spanish history is incredibly complicated.
It's crazy,
I am very far from an expert.
Yeah.
And there are still issues with like a lot of Catalans and a lot of Basque still want like some, at least some degree of independence from the Spanish state. Yeah.
Yeah, recognition from the nation. Yeah.
Yeah. And they all have their own languages and cultural traditions. And one of the things that I learned that's interesting actually is that the like Spanish, what we know as Spanish, comes from the chunk of like the language group that was kind of most dominant in Iberia, but they actually stole the word for the country from, I think it was the Catalans. So like it's mm-hmm. Very complicated history. And for most of Spanish history, the only unifying factors of all these very disparate groups of people were the crown, the king, and the Catholic mm-hmm. Church. And mainly the Catholic Church, right? Yeah. Now, in the 1800s, Spain was dominated by a revolution, or Spain was kind of overtaken, Spanish thought was overtaken by a revolution in classical liberalism, right? That sort mm-hmm. of takes over a lot of parts of Europe at this point in time.
Yeah.
And Spain is included in that. But in Spain, this kind of new liberal wave largely failed to push for any kind of mass Spanish identity. It didn't, like, and you, this is where you start to get, like, French identity, right? And like, but you don't really get that. In France, it starts earlier than the 1800s, but like you don't really get that in a big way in Spain. And part of the reason is that kind of the cultural elites fail to institute any meaningful education reforms for the majority of the population. Like France in the same period establishes a functional education system. And by contrast, Spain's failure to do this means that education remained the purview of the Catholic Church. They do most of the educating, and it's only for the wealthy. And the country would deal with widespread illiteracy well into the 1900s. And when you don't have mass public education, one of the things you don't have is a widespread idea of the history and like what your nation is. And like, right, that's part of why.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's not nationalism is not really much of a thing in Spain as a result of this.
They're too busy killing off Mesoamericans.
And they're absolutely, that's one of the things that's weird. They're a huge imperial power. In some ways, they're the first world power.
Yeah.
Like the first power that's like on a level of like what the U.S. was earlier in our lifetimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing like being a Californian married to a Mexican woman, like, you know, you have to somehow kind of know a little Spanish history as to why these Mayans are speaking Spanish. You know what I'm saying? And like, you know, cause the part of Mexico she's from, they're from Southern Mexico. So like they're kind of Mayan, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, this like weird, like how they exported this like colorism and just this weird eliteness but at the same time, can't nobody in your country read, you know? So it was just this weird like thing happening with Spain. Yeah.
It's very weird. And like, if we're going to be completely fair, like if you look at the system of sort of slavery that was instituted in what we now call Latin America, it's one of the few systems of slavery in history that's like on the same level as what we had in the American South.
Yeah.
Like absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
And genocides. So I'm not trying to like whitewash Spanish history.
No, not
by
at
saying
all.
They don't have nationalism. It's just not, it's not the same as it is with a lot of
colonial
powers.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, but I'm adding to it. Like it's peculiar. Yeah. That they had such an imperialistic power without this like national identity.
Yeah, it's very odd. Like Spain is an interesting country to study.
Yeah.
Now, the Catholic Church was a major force in Spain for pushing against the development of a modern liberal state, right? In the 1800s, you don't really have nations anywhere up until like that concept kind of starts like in the 1700s. Shit's a lot less. The idea of like a nation, the way that we conceive of one, is kind of born in this period, 1800s. Okay. And the Catholic Church in Spain really pushes against the modern liberal state. Mm-hmm. This was largely due to the fact that liberalism had an anti-clerical bias, right? The Catholic Church for the medieval period is like the most the big power in the world, right? They have influence everywhere in Christendom, and they start to lose it in this period because governments are like, well, where are we going to let a church in Italy tell our government like we're England? I don't give a shit what you say. And the Catholicism's huge in Spain, and the church is like, well, we don't want any of this shit going on. So
yeah,
Spain the church pushes against kind of a lot of modernizing ideas. And one of those things is that Spain fails to develop a modern military system. And while it was, again, a massive military power, they never do like what France does, where you start this idea of a nation under arms and a modern professional style of the military. That takes a lot longer to develop in Spain. And okay. It's part of why they don't do so well when everyone else develops a modern military, right? And they start losing their empire, both to a combination of European powers taking their shit from them and from a lot of revolutions in places they had controlled that overthrows them.
Yeah.
And so the 1700s and 1800s see a rapid decline in Spanish power. And it had been declining before then, but Now, the ultimate collapse of Spanish imperialism really comes in 1898 when the United States goes to war with Spain for no reason, really, and takes over Cuba and the Philippines.
Just take Cuba.
Yeah, just because. Like, it's a just because thing.
Randomly, just like... you want a new imperial power? We could be that.
And there, you know, Spain is an unbelievably brutal, particularly in the Philippines. And then we take over and we're unbelievably brutal in the Philippines. And the people there are like, oh, you guys, so are we going to have a democracy now? And we're like, no. We want your shit. Like, we want your shit, you know?
No, we're going to take your shit. We're setting you free so we can own you. That's, I mean...
It's that kind of freedom.
It's that kind of freedom.
Like, we don't even let women in our country vote. You think we're going to let you vote?
What are you talking about?
It's 1898, motherfuckers. So, interesting.
No. Nothing changes. It's just your leaders speak English now.
Our guns are better. Our guns are a lot guns better than Spanish guns. Oh, their guns sucked. That's why we're in charge now. Colonialism. So one of the things that's interesting about Spain is late 1800s, you know, 1890s, early 1900s, that's like the height of colonialism, right before World War I starts, like murders a lot of the great powers that controlled the whole world. So like they are riding high. Africa's just been like, you know, murdered like in a lot of ways, like colonized. The scramble for Africa's like at its height. You know, Belgium owns the Congo. It's that period.
Yeah.
So everyone else who's doing imperialism is doing gangbusters, and Spain's empire collapses. So what happens to everyone else in like the 50s, 60s, 70s really happens to Spain like a couple of generations earlier. So they actually go through they're an empire who goes through the collapse of colonialism while everyone else is doing great at colonialism, which is one of the things that makes them very interesting.
Yeah.
So some of the things that happen in colonial powers when their empires collapse, these things that we've seen in Germany and France and England and that we're seeing now in the United States, happen in Spain in the late 1890s, because it's just the stuff that happens when you're an empire that fails. I find that really interesting. Historian Stanley Payne calls 1898 the first modern post-colonial trauma in Western Europe. And I think you do have to view it as a trauma for the people in Spain. And probably the best equivalent to our own society would be the ongoing trauma that a lot of Americans have faced in Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah. And I'm not trying to minimize the traumas faced in those countries as a result of U.S. action, which are commensurately greater. But we've seen in the MAGA movement, right? And all of these that have come home and stormed the Capitol and shit. Like, it is a trauma. It's a trauma when you're an empire that fails. It fucks people up who were used to being the empire.
I find that part, like, you know, as again, being a black dude, being like, you know, the saying, you know, that like equality is oppression if all you know is privilege.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? So like when, if you're so used to the system working for you, the second it doesn't, you're like, something must be broken. You're like, well, no, it was broke. That's why it only worked for you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It was always broke.
You were
one of the people it worked for. So, Spain deals with this post-colonial trauma very early, right? Before the rest of the Western world, right, really does, because it fails for them. They were the first for it to work, and they were the first that it failed for, which I guess makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, like in the U.S., all those failing colonial ventures that we had flooded the United States with disaffected veterans, debt, and it fueled the rise of a resentful right wing, as well as fueling the rise of a dissident left wing, right?
Sheesh,
like, all of that stuff was really... incited in a lot of ways by, and obviously I'm not calling the dissident left a bad thing, but like those horrible colonial wars we had really fueled a lot of that. And the situation in Spain after 1898 is not all that different. Now, With her years as a great power seemingly behind her, Spanish intellectuals begin to wonder if the sense of exceptionalism that they'd always taken for granted had been based on false premises. And I'm going to quote from historian Stanley Payne here. I know, right? Interesting.
Yeah.
Symptomatic of the dismay of the nationalist military was an editorial in El Heraldo Militar on 23rd November 1908 entitled "Worse Than Anywhere." It declared, "Wherever we look, we find greater virility than in our own people. In Turkey, Persia, China, the Balkan states, everywhere we find life and energy, even in Russia. In Spain, there is only apathy and submission. How sad it is to think about the situation in Spain."
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of feels like us and the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
We're like...
Yeah, I think Americans can identify with a lot of what
just like, wait,
they're hearing here. Even if you don't like feel it, because colonialism's bad, you know the intellectuals in our own society who are saying the same shit, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Now, the Spanish political system was not at all stable domestically during the period after, like, while her empire was in free fall. And that's part of why the empire didn't last. From 1803 to the early 1900s, there were more than a dozen military coups. Between 1833 and 1876, Spain was racked by three civil wars, the Carlist Wars, which were not battles against everybody's favorite tertiary Simpsons character, but were instead members of a conservative pro-church political movement. The Carlists were the violent armed wing of Catholics, right? They were the embodiment of clerical resentment against liberal Spain. They were religious extremists who didn't want the country to modernize. And I found a very detailed write-up for students on Limon.uk that notes the Carlist Wars, quote, "were fought with a fervor and brutality derived from deep divisions within Spain. They also lasted longer than national wars and were more difficult to resolve. They anticipated the Spanish Civil War in a number of respects. There was a strong element of different and conflicting beliefs within the country, profound traditional Catholicism against modern liberal thought, regional independence against traditional central control, political liberalism against deep conservative monarchism." So this is all the stuff that's been cooking up in the background of Spanish politics at the turn of the 20th century. Now, partly as a result of the Carlist Wars, Spain had a relatively underdeveloped right wing in this period because, you know, a lot of them had gotten killed in wars. And they'd been very tied to the church. So there wasn't as much of like a nationalist right wing. It was a Catholic right wing. Now, Spanish nationalism, as I said, was kind of nascent and didn't really start to erupt into the street until after World War One. Spain was neutral in World War One, so you'd think they might be in a better position because they don't really get involved in this shit. And it does delay a lot of political extremism in the country. It's why they don't have, like, you know, a communist movement that's really a big deal until after the war.
Yeah.
The first big street fight in Spain between radical political groups actually happened between two opposed groups of nationalists in 1919. Radical Catalanists, which are like big like advocates of Catalan separatism, had been holding peaceful nightly demonstrations in favor of independence throughout 1918. In January of 1919, a group of right-wing Españolistas, who were like nationalists, violent Spanish nationalists, assaulted this gathering of peaceful Catalanists. Both groups battled it out in the streets of Barcelona in what would soon become a familiar display. The Españolistas were a mix of local army officers and men from a group calling itself the Liga Patriótica Española. This violence was soon superseded by a spree of organized political murders by anarcho-syndicalists from a labor federation called the CNT. And this is like unrelated to the national separatism. There's also, and we'll talk about anarchism in a second, but a bunch of anarchist extremists start murdering people based on based on class, really.
Yeah.
And that brings us a temporary stop to all of the street fighting because the murders bring the cops out against all sorts of what are considered to be political extremists. And it briefly it's what we're about to see in the United States.
And it
briefly clamps down on all political organization in the streets. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, great.
In most of Western Europe, anarchists tended to be smaller. Like they weren't fairly rare for anarchists to make a large percentage of political radicals in a European country. Okay. And it's much more common for like socialists and communists to be a significant sized force. Ukraine would be an exception to that. We talked about Nestor Makhno on our Christmas episodes. And part of why Ukraine had a large and organized anarchist movement is that Ukraine was largely agrarian. And one of the things we see in like Europe in this period of time is that nations that have a large industrial base and a lot of industrial workers have a huge communist movement. Nations that are primarily rural and agricultural have a large anarchist movement because anarchists are more common, kind of come out of agrarian rural communities more often than communism. Because communism is a workers' movement. Marx early on in his career was very much like, kind of wrote off for a long time, rural people. Was like, no, it's all about the workers. It's about industrial, like them you can organize and you can use them to take, you know, take over the system, basically. And like rural people are kind of a lost cause. And he did change on that later in his life and stuff. But like, that's part of why you don't really see communism erupt out of rural areas in this period. You see anarchism when you see left-wing extremism.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm going to quote it. Yeah, it's interesting, right? I didn't actually know that until I never thought of that.
Yeah.
And that's part of why when I think about ways in which to pull people in rural America away from right-wing extremism, I think of more systems like democratic confederalism or libertarian municipalism like Bookchin that are kind of more of an out of a more anarchist view. Because like a lot of these libertarians, I do think you can pull into a more reasonable system that's not right-wing extremism, because a lot of their basic ideology is I want to be left alone. And I think you could be like, well, we want to leave you alone. We just also would like to be left alone. Can we figure out a way to like, so I'm going to quote from Limon.uk again on kind of politics in Spain in this period. Quote, capitalist industry had not developed in the same ways it had in Germany, Britain, and America, and Spain had little in the way of organized labor. After small-scale beginnings in 1868, anarchism came to be a major revolutionary influence of the 20th century and was more widely embraced in Spain than other left-wing ideas. The movement first gained notice in the 1870s. After a violent incident at the town of Alcoy in 1873, when anarchists took advantage of a strike to spread radical ideas, causing the police to fire on the gathered populace, a clampdown was enforced that sent the movement underground. Consequently, it became largely based in rural areas, which were more difficult to police. Anarchism was reduced to individual acts of terrorism, which in turn were met by repression and torture by the state throughout the 1880s and 1890s. By the early 20th century, terrorism had given way to a belief in anarcho-syndicalism. This was the theory that the state could be challenged by cooperative action by the workers in strikes. The Federation of Workers' Societies and of the Spanish region was formed in 1900. This movement organized strikes to exercise political power and was again suppressed. Wage cuts and closures of factories in Barcelona in 1909, together with the call-up of men for a colonial war in Morocco, led to a general strike in the city on 26th of July. This turned out to be a major event, with 1,700 arrests, attacks on railway lines and anti-clericalism, hostility to the church. 80 churches and monasteries were attacked. The government response was swift and merciless, and five leaders were executed. And this is a big thing with, like, particularly the anarchists in Spain. They burn a lot of churches down, and they kill a lot of Catholic priests. And some of that, a lot of that is them murdering people who didn't deserve it. And a lot of them, that is them murdering people who did, because the Catholic Church is also terrible. Like,
kind of wild. They're pretty out of pocket. Let's not sugarcoat this.
If you're looking for like a pure good guy or a pure victim, you will rarely find it in this. Yeah. Like there are, right? Yeah. Like obviously I'm not saying like there's nuns and shit that get murdered. That's not chill.
Yeah,
the Catholic Church is also responsible for horrible repression. It's very messy. You know?
Yeah. They have their own, you know, both versions of like Bastard episode of the good Christmas one. That's like, oh, we invented orphanages. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's like, oh, that's actually great. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And then there's this. Yeah.
And the Catholic Church is so big, because you can also, you could obviously, we could do multiple episodes, and we probably will at some point, about the massive and pervasive sexual abuse of children that was enabled by the Catholic Church. We could and should also do a Christmas episode on the significant number of priests and nuns in Latin America who were like dogged and constant enemies of U.S. imperialism and right-wing extremism during like the period when the U.S. was doing most of its fucking around in Latin America. All of that's part of the church's history.
All of it's true. That like half of our hospital beds are actually Catholic. You know what I'm saying? This like weird mix.
I'm not a person who wants to like simplify all this. It's very messy. Yeah, yeah. And this is a messy episode.
Messy, so, boy.
By this point, when you've got these anarcho-syndicalists organizing and like and in some cases carrying out, not all of them, but some of them carrying out terrorist attacks, and some of those attacks are on shitty people and some of those attacks are on people who don't deserve it, like it's very messy. And at the same period of time, you've got Gabriel D'Annunzio in Italy occupying, well, I guess in Yugoslavia, occupying the city of Fiume, and you've got Mussolini in the early stages of forming his black shirts and sicking them on left-wing newspapers. Ooh. This is happening contemporaneously to that.
You're going to have to release with this one a vocabulary list. This is, you've introduced some new names, some new words to some people.
We talked about D'Annunzio and Few.
No, I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about the different factions in Spain.
You said a
narco anarchist.
Syndicalism. Yeah.
Yeah, anarcho, so, you know what I'm saying? A sternocleidomastoid out this bug. You know what I mean?
Anarcho-syndicalist. The basic idea is that workers who work for in like different factories or whatever, who work in farms or whatever, need to form syndicates together to organize, kind of like unions, to organize and have syndicates that work together against the state and against capital in order to, in some cases, just gain better wages for workers, in some cases in order to revolt against the system. But like, it's this idea that different groups of workers need to organize themselves and then work with other organizations of workers rather than having bosses in a strict hierarchy.
And they totally need to sell drugs. That's why they call it narcos.
Yeah. The good thing about this period is that drugs are all legal everywhere. So by this point, like I said, D'Annunzio's occupying Fiume and Mussolini's in the early stages of like forming the Black Shirts. Fascism's getting started in Italy. And in Spain, though, anarchists are by far the largest and best organized group of political radicals in the country. The communists aren't really a big factor, and the right wing isn't really a big factor. It's just kind of the anarchists fighting the government a lot of the time. And the Catholic Church, you know, is kind of a lot of their like supporters are kind of taking the part of right wing organizing. But the Carlist Wars kind of drained them, so it's not a big deal there. And this is not really the case anywhere else that you could think of, and it's part of why I find Spain so interesting. Fascism, by contrast, had a much slower time starting off in Spain. Portugal actually beat Spain to the punch when it came to like having fascists.
Yeah.
And it was because a proto-nationalist group called Nacionalismo Lusitano was formed in Lisbon in 1923, and it was directly inspired by Mussolini's Italian fascism. Now, a number of other Mussolini wannabes sprang up in Europe during this period. You could even call Hitler at the time of the beer hall putsch kind of like a Mussolini imitator.
Yeah.
But the idea didn't really catch on in Spain, not yet. Spanish intellectuals were, however, watching events in Italy. And one of them, a guy named Foy, suggested that this new political system might just be the thing to help rebuild Spain's failing empire. He wrote of fascism as a social movement. It gave voice to a vein of mysticism and idealism that exalted the concept of the patria and its full realization, the concept of the fatherland.
Yeah, yeah, patria. There's a patria coffee shop in Compton.
Yeah. Anyway, carry on. With some troubling. Yeah. So the name of the game for Foy was national restoration. But Mussolini's fun idea was popular outside of right-wing circles, too. There was actually a left-wing Catalan separatist movement that found themselves drawn to Italian fascism, particularly its emphasis on militia-based direct action. Hmm. And they weren't fascists. They didn't embrace, for example, Mussolini's doctrine of therapeutic violence, you know, the cult of violence for violence's sake. Yeah. They just liked, number one, the imagery of this non-state group of armed people marching in order to take power for themselves, and they wanted to do that. So like the left is, when we talked about this in our first episode, a lot of folks who are just kind of hate the system play with both fascist and anarchist and left and right wing ideas throughout this period of time.
Also, I like that you brought up Portugal, because I feel like they always fly under the radar. Like,
they do.
They're just everybody just not noticing. They could just exist in the shadows. They was the first in Africa. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so like,
yeah.
Like nobody, like how come nobody ever talk about Portugal?
And they're also the case of a country that was incredibly powerful and colonized a fuckload of the world and then collapsed before the rest of colonialism did.
Yeah.
And you see the same thing happen in Portugal, where all these authoritarians start coming into power because there's this sense of like, we need a strong man. And this is like intellectuals in Spain will be like, we have to, or in Portugal will be like, we can't have a republic for a while. We have to have basically a dictator come in because he needs to fix everything. Like we have all these problems. We can't argue. We just need one visionary to come in.
Yeah.
And it's not quite fascism, but it has a lot of elements of that, right?
Yeah.
So, Robert, can you hit an ad break real quick?
You know what else has elements of fascism, Sophie?
Capitalism.
No. Capitalism.
Not a good transition for sponsors aspects. And services.
Yeah. Here's. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone in our country has a voice. It's something that says not just where you come from, but who you are. Welcome to NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of podcasts and a celebration of the hosts in journalism who've always spoken truth to power. Our voices are as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, and stories should never be about us without us. Find NPR Black Stories, Black Truths on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
We're back
if by strong man you mean a strong Sophie that keeps us in been placed in, yes, these ads have elements of fascism, but it's a good fascism. It's a fashionism forward,
which is
fascism.
It's fine
and we because their glasses are dope.
Yeah, we appreciate our podcast dictator, Sophie.
Yes, our podcast dictator.
Who rules with an iron fist and does operate a system of political re-education camps. But that is a story for another episode.
Correct.
So, in late 1923, Spain gained its first real fascist party, the Tracistas. They wore a blue uniform because blue's the color of the working class. For the right wing, red is the color of the working class. For the left wing, right? Yeah. Like I know. It's we got it backwards here, which is weird, right? They wore a blue uniform and they hoped to spread throughout the country, but the organization fizzled. There just wasn't any real interest in fascism in Spain in this period. Now, while political fascism failed to gain meaningful purchase in Spain during this time, fascist thought and inclinations were spreading among a lot of influential Spanish thought leaders, and particularly within the military and military officers. Much of this had to do with the rise of the revolutionary left in the 1890s, these anarchists that I was talking about. In his landmark book, Fascism in Spain, scholar Stanley Payne notes that the military resistance to the left had less to do with politics than you might expect. Officers largely accepted moderate left-wing social and economic aims, and there was even a strong strain of anti-capitalist thought among Spanish military leaders. Despite this, Payne writes, army officers demanded suppression of the left's disorder, violence, and subversion of national unity. So again, it's this, the military's big problem with the left is they're disordered, right? They're trying to tear down this system, and we're doing pretty well in this system. I mean, it's a thing that is always the case, right?
Yeah. This is messy, because
the military itself was also heavily divided in this time, not along political lines, but between bureaucratic officers on the peninsula itself and combat officers who'd spent time fighting in Spain's last colonial possession, Northern Morocco. So Spain's most of its empires has collapsed right now, but they have northern Morocco. And Spain had gotten Morocco basically during the last stages of the scramble for Africa, and it was given to them by France and England, who, you might notice, don't have the right to give Morocco to anyone, but they did. And it was due to, like, diplomatic support that Spain gave them. Like, it was literally, like, it was them the way that, like, a normal person would be like, hey, man, I'll help you move if you help me set up my sound system this weekend.
Yeah.
Like, that's how Spain got Morocco. It's very...
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's also, some bullshit.
It's also a beautiful country.
Gorgeous, yeah.
Morocco's beautiful, anyway.
Now, so they were given the right to occupy the land by France and England in 1906 in exchange for diplomatic support. And Spain's conquest of Morocco was kind of like the first one night stand you have after a breakup. They just had like a big, you know, they needed something to boost their confidence after losing to the United States. And Spain turned out to be pretty bad at conquering Morocco. Their control never amounted to much more than a few towns, cities, and roads on the coast. Much of the territory and its people refused to yield. And in 1921, a charismatic Moroccan leader named Abdul Karim rose an army and launched what became known as the Rifi Insurrection. For a time, it was the strongest rebellion against colonialism anywhere in the Afro-Asian world. Like, these guys actually do great for a while, you know? Now, the war attracted ambitious young Spanish officers, eager to make a name for themselves. One of these guys was a fellow named Francisco Franco, who rose to the rank of colonel fighting the insurgents. Now, Francisco and a lot of young officers were very frustrated by the corrupt and bureaucratic nature of the military, which had not seen a major reorganization or modernization in decades. It was a lot, in a lot of ways, like a Napoleonic army with, you know, somewhat better guns, which is why, part of why they're getting their asses kicked.
Yeah.
Now, Franco and a number of other officers formed military councils of like-minded officers and lobbied for reforms, and some of those reforms were successful. But nothing they did was enough to right the inertia. In early 1921, the Spanish army launched an offensive into northern Morocco from the coastal territories they held. Now, because the people in charge were idiots, they didn't properly prepare lines of communication, and they almost immediately advanced beyond their supply lines. No defensible forts were left behind to secure supply routes or water, and on July 22nd, after 5 days of skirmishes, a force of 5,000 Spanish troops were attacked by 3,000 Rif fighters. This should have been an easy win for a European military, but the Spanish had poor organization and were basically out of ammo because they'd outrun their supply lines. So the Rifi, like, overrun the Spanish army, and they advanced, like, several hundred miles, slaughtering Spanish soldiers, taking over supply depots and positions as they go. The Spanish army shatters entirely. They lose more than 13,000 men wounded in a matter of days, and the Rif suffer around 800 casualties. This is, like, one of the worst defeats suffered by any colonial power in Africa. Like, it is, they get their asses handed to them.
Yeah, I was like, woo!
The defeat was so extensive and so shameful that the Spanish general committed suicide in the field and his remains were never found. Like, it is
out
bad.
In the desert out there.
And the Rif, this whole insurrection is fascinating to read about because, like, these guys fucking have it on lockdown, you know? It is hard to imagine how shattering this was to the people of Spain and their image of themselves, and how much it disrupted Spanish politics. The military was, of course, enraged, and even though the failures were entirely their own, they blame their failures on the civilian government. It's y'all's fault! It's y'all's fault we're bad at war.
That's what's wrong with my machismo. You know what I'm saying? It's like, well could
I didn't lose this war.
Yeah.
I mean, you see it on the right here where it's like it was the liberals and like the left that lost us the wars. And they're like, no, we suck at this. We're at it.
You look, man, take it on the chin. Okay.
We're bad at it. And it's bad.
You shouldn't have been there in the first place.
If we'd fucking stopped this shit in, like, I don't know, 1945, we'd still be like, you know what we're good at is war. Don't have to do it often. But we're good at it.
But when we show up, it's
when
real.
We show up.
Yeah.
Now, again, really fucks up a lot in Spain at this period of time. And obviously the liberal government is also enraged, largely at the cost in Spanish life and treasure in this colonial adventure. And in early September 1923, three liberal ministers resign in protest because the military draws up plans for a new offensive in Morocco. And they're like, come on, guys, like, you just got your asses kicked. This is a terrible idea.
Fellas.
Can you not take the message? It's bad.
It's bad, dog.
Catalanists who didn't even really want to be part of Spain, let alone send their sons to die in fucking Morocco for Spain, right? Held a huge rally in Barcelona where the Spanish flag was dragged through the ground. Sheesh. This really pisses off the military, and it pisses off a bunch of senior generals, most prominently a career military man from a career military family named Miguel Primo de Rivera. Now, as the Captain General of Barcelona, the guy in charge of the military in Barcelona, de Rivera was a desk officer, not an African veteran, and that's kind of like the break between the army. Yeah, but divas. He sides with the African veterans, and he sees this liberal government as having failed his illustrious Spanish army. He also had seen Mussolini's March on Rome in 1922, and while he is not a fascist, he really likes Mussolini, and the March on Rome convinces him that with the army behind him, he could force an end to the parliamentary politics that he felt were holding the military back. And I'm going to quote now from a book called Fascism in Spain, about like this revolt that de Rivera leads. The revolt began in Barcelona as a classic pronunciamiento. I'm sorry, Spain.
It's all good.
With a local takeover in the Catalan capital by its captain general, who called upon the rest of the army and other patriotic Spaniards to rally round. In fact, also in the traditional style, all but one of the other captains general at first sat on their fence. The pronunciamiento succeeded, above all, because the liberal government did almost nothing to defend itself. The issue was finally decided 2 days later by the crown, as Alfonso VIII, without invoking constitutional limits or procedures, transferred power to what would become the first direct military dictatorship in Spanish history. Primo de Rivera gave no evidence of any explicit theory or plan. His assumption of power was at first predicated on a 90-day emergency military directory to deal with such problems as attempted subversion, the stalemate in Morocco, administrative corruption, and political reform. In fact, his only professed ideology was constitutional liberalism. He insisted that the Constitution of 1876 remained the law of the land and initially denied that he was a dictator in any genuine sense, insisting in his first public statement, "No one can, with justice, apply that term to me." Of course, everyone since has called him a dictator.
Yeah, he's a dictator.
What is it about? I have two questions about this. Like, I forget what historian I heard say it, but he's just talking about like just generals. Like they all kind of have this like diva gene. Like they're just kind of divas. You know what I'm saying? Like it's kind of hard to like. What is that? So that's like my first thing.
It's very deep in Western civilization, particularly, right? Like you have to look back to Rome at this stuff. So the way generals in Rome were treated, number one, if you were a general in Rome and you had a major military victory, the Senate would vote for you to have what was called a triumph, which is where you were all but in all but name king for a day of Rome. And there was this, the whole city had this huge party for you and all of your trophies of war were dragged through the streets. And like, because you were so powerful and so like basically worshipped that day, it was one guy's whole job to stand next to you the whole time and throughout the day whisper to you, "You will die at one point. Like you're going to die someday."
To remember.
And Rome constantly had civil wars that were the result of generals taking their armies and taking power. It happened all of the fucking time.
Yeah.
It's why you got Caesar. It's why it stopped being a republic, you know?
Yeah.
One of the reasons why the United States military is organized the way it is and why there's such, if you look at like some of the shit the military was saying at the end of Trump's time, like why they had so many statements about the military having no role in the elections is because from the beginning, the founders of this country were like, "That's going to be a problem.
It's
like,
gonna
if we're
going to
have
issue.
A military, that's going to be a." And at first, a lot of them were like, "We shouldn't have a military. Why would you?" Like, it always is a problem. Let's just have a bunch of militias.
Yeah.
You know, which there's something to be said for that. Anyway,
but divas,
they are divas. Like, if you're going to take the responsibility for the lives of tens of thousands of men into your own personal control, you got to be a little bit of a diva, right?
Kind of. It seemed like it. Anyway.
So, obviously, everyone today calls Primo de Rivera a dictatorship. The years of his leadership are generally known in Spanish history as La Dictadura. And this was met, like, his coming to power was met by a lot less resistance than you might guess. Spain was exhausted by years of political bickering, foreign policy setbacks, and economic frustration. Several years earlier, political theorists in Portugal had talked about the need to bring in a temporary dictator, what they called an iron surgeon, to solve intractable problems. And Primo de Rivera was one of a lot of strongmen who came to power throughout Europe in this period who weren't fascists, although they often admired fascists and took some ideas from them. But de Rivera doesn't really have an ideology. He's just wants to like fix things and figures is enough of a narcissist that he's like, I know how to do this. Mm-hmm. And while Di Rivera wasn't a fascist, his brief reign would help further lay the groundwork for fascism in Spain. Mm-hmm. And the war that he brought to Morocco was in many ways a prelude of fascist wars of extermination to come. Only it was waged with the help of his allies, the French.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
See, after the Spanish army broke at Annual, which is that big battle where they lose like 13,000 dudes, the Abdel Karim, who was the guy in charge of the Rif, and his like, I don't know what you want to call them. I'll call them revolutionaries.
Yeah.
Established a republic. Now, France, who just fought a whole war, you know, World War One, over what they claimed was the right of national self-determination, and who were a republic themselves, did not like that Abdel Karim and his Rif had established a republic in Morocco, because they're afraid they own a bunch of Africa. They own a bunch of Africa near Morocco.
Very close.
Like,
yeah.
People are going to hear that there's a republic that isn't run by Europe, and they're not going to want to have us in charge anymore.
Wait, this is an option?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Not having y'all as an option?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can have a democracy and not you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of sound like, yeah.
I kind of like that. Yeah.
Yeah. France is like, no, that's not going to happen.
No. Not an option.
Not an option.
Yeah.
So they decide to enter the war against the Rif on Spain's side to crush the rebels. In 1925, France and Di Rivera's reformed Spanish army begin a counteroffensive against the Rif. Now, leading things on the French side was a fella named Marshal Pétain, hero of the Battle of Verdun during World War I, and the guy who would become the leader of Vichy France during World War II. He's the guy who collaborates with the Nazis. Now, Pétain, at this point, yeah, I know, he's a real piece of shit.
Yeah, how come the Moroccans didn't kill this guy?
He's a war hero at this point, too, though, because he led France through the Battle of Verdun. Is if you're making a short list of the very worst battles in the entire history of human warfare, Verdun might be number one. You know, Stalingrad, there's a couple of other like, but it's in the running. You know, it's horrible. Like a million people die. It's a terrible battle. So he's a big war hero. And when he decides he wants to go to Morocco, the French government is going to give him everything he asks for. So he puts together a force of 150,000 men to face Abdel Karim's tribesmen, who were very well organized and good fighters, but they numbered just 20,000. The offensive started with one of the first amphibious landings. Yeah.
There's no like Gandalf showing up and helping.
We don't get a Gandalf in this story. I'm sorry.
You are outgunned and outmanned.
Yeah, you guys are just like you're fucked. It's a bummer.
Yeah.
And this amphibious landing is spearheaded by a young colonel named Francisco Franco, who led the soldiers of the Spanish Foreign Legion into battle. Now, you have seen the Spanish Foreign Legion. Everyone in America pretty much did, because at the start of the coronavirus lockdown, when Spain had a lockdown and brought in the military to help, there were pictures of a bunch of very jacked and very handsome Spanish soldiers in incredibly tight-fitting uniforms marching down the streets of Barcelona.
Yeah.
And a bunch of U.S. liberals were like, oh my God, they're so hot. Why can't we have those soldiers here?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you the backstory of those soldiers, because the men of the Spanish Foreign Legion. It's not a great backstory.
Oh, no. So what's crazy is about like the geography right now. Like, I don't know this backstory that you're about to say, but I'm just picturing the geography, because off of Costa del Sol at the edge of the edge of Spain to the tip of Tangiers in Morocco, it's just the Mediterranean Sea. It's a 90-minute boat ride.
Yeah, it's not
like
a far ride.
It's not far. It's almost like you could sit in Morocco and watch them. Like, hey, here come the Spanish.
You can get to Spain. You can get from Spain to Africa in the time you would get a quarter of the way across Texas. Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's nothing.
Yeah, it's not
it really is. Yeah.
Do we know who designed the uniforms?
We're going to talk about why the uniforms look the way they do. Yeah.
Ah.
So the Spanish Foreign Legion were founded.
Wait, Sophie. He's not a pointy motherfucker.
No.
They're hot.
They're hot.
Like,
these uniforms, they're like a nice, like,
they are hot. Nobody's arguing that they're not
the
hot.
Pants are subjectively way too tight.
Yeah, no one is arguing that they're not good-looking men.
Yeah, we're not going to disagree about this.
But problematic. No, no, no. So they're found. The Spanish Foreign Legion was founded in 1919 in mimicry of the French Foreign Legion, since Spain was also mimicking French ambitions in North Africa at this point. The founder of the Legion was a guy named Milan Estray, a veteran of Spain's brutal war in the Philippines and of the fighting in Morocco. And he wanted to create a colonial army for Spain that they could use to regain some of their lost glory. He created an interlocking series as he founded, like when he founded the Foreign Legion. He wanted them to be brutal, because if you're going to keep a colonial possession, you have to murder a lot of people, right?
Sheesh.
That's how colonialism works. You have to kill a lot of people.
Good God.
And so your soldiers have to be soulless, broken men in order to gun down the proper number of children to keep an empire.
He wanted shock troops.
Yeah.
And and fine as hell.
She just sent me the picture.
That's why I was like, good God.
God damn. I know. God nobody's damn, arguing. Like,
cisgender.
I get why the reaction was what it is.
Yes.
Like the Spanish Foreign Legion today look like characters in a pornography. They don't look like real soldiers, they look like fake soldiers from a sleazy porn. And they kind of did then. So Milan Estray, in order to make sure these guys are as brutal as possible, creates for them an interlocking series of hazing rituals with the goal of like shattering these men's souls. And I want to separate these men from their past lives and unify them in, quote, brotherhood and death. Now,
God dog.
Milan Estray was a big fan of the Bushido code of the samurai.
Oh, here we go.
All of these fucking guys. And he cribs from Bushido to write his own legionary creed, which emphasized tireless duty, bodily hardness, which is why they're all jacked, unconditional brotherhood, and fighting to the death. And I'm going to quote from a write-up in Prospect magazine on the Foreign Legion here. Many of these themes were common across fascist movements and the militaries they influenced, but others were distinct to the Legion. Legionaries swore to become bridegrooms of death, from the title of a popular song about a legionnaire's sacrifice in the Rif, renouncing familial and romantic bonds and sublimating them into loyalty to each other and the Legion's flag. You are married to death. Death is your wife.
Sheesh. Like, not married to the streets. You're not married to the game.
Yeah.
You married to death.
So if you think these guys are hot, I have bad news for you. They're fucking the Grim Reaper.
Sorry. You don't attract them.
Yeah.
You are too alive for me. That's not my type.
Yeah. These guys, the reason why they have these shirts with like really open, weird necklines is that...
I'm going to need you to rephrase that.
What?
What's weird about that? Good for them. They have sex. They're showing it off. Why are they showing it off?
It's also meant to emphasize their willingness to fight in the hot desert air.
And the green is from the color, early camouflage.
Yeah.
Sophie need her a zaddy.
This is what I wish was normal.
Sophie, they are married to the concept of murdering children. I'm sorry.
I mean, I'm not here for that, but the
they even got bulges, dog. Like,
I know they have bulges.
Right. I said the pants are subjectively too tight, but like, go ahead.
This is not functional.
It's like a nice pastel mint color, you know?
None of that. This uniform is like functional.
They're not.
You have to be married to death because nothing about this says you ready to survive.
It kind of looks like if the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz worked at Baskin Robbins and had to go do a porno shoot later.
So Franco and his Foreign Legion men. Franco and his Foreign Legion men were the tip of the spear of the French and Spanish governments thrust into the heart of Morocco.
Okay, you know what you just did there.
Nice.
Are you joking?
I know.
Are
yeah,
you
I know.
Nice.
I know, Sophie, but we're about to talk about genocide, okay?
Okay, but you know what you just did there. You know what? We need to take a break.
Tip of the spear doesn't just mean a dick.
We need to take a break, Robert.
Thrusted.
All right. We're
going
to go to ads. And then we're going to talk about a colonial genocide.
Fine.
Yes.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone in our country has a voice. It's something that says not just where you come from, but who you are. Welcome to NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of podcasts and a celebration of the hosts in journalism who've always spoken truth to power. Our voices are as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, and stories should never be about us without us. Find NPR Black Stories, Black Truths on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
All right. We're back, and we are no longer talking about hot guys. We're talking about the genocide those hot guys helped commit. Well, kind of.
You brought it up like that. Anyway. You know what you're doing, bro.
I'm trying to emphasize that sometimes things that look nice are also fashy as hell, and people might be on guard.
Sometimes the good looks will stick it to you.
So the overwhelming force.
You know what force, you just did there too.
Overwhelming force? No. That's anyway.
Yeah, they just thrust their power all over.
Okay, goddammit.
Damn it. Okay.
You know what you're doing.
Okay.
I know I'm trying to talk about the use of chemical war weapons upon civilians.
All I'm saying is I've never wished Jamie Loftus was here more than right now.
I am very glad
she would murder us in the double entendres.
Jesus Christ.
A professional at this.
Jesus Christ. Yeah.
I love you, Jamie.
The French and the Spanish have so many soldiers and so much high-grade military hardware that there is no chance the Rif are going to actually win. Victory was only a matter of time. But De Rivera and Marshal Petain were not willing to wait, and so they started using chemical weapons to slaughter tribespeople en masse. And they're not using them on military forces. They first start bombarding the city of Tangier with phosgene gas, which is a deadly chemical weapon. It's what they used in the trenches. It chokes people to death on their own rotting lungs.
Yeah.
It's horrific stuff. The Spanish army began pounding the outskirts of the town, and as soon as Spanish forces started gassing tribespeople, other commanders in the country begged to be able to do the same. One Spanish general wrote of his desire to use them being chemical weapons, with delight. This was all very good for France, who profited not just from stability in Northern Africa, but because they were selling Spain the gas, they also profited financially. I'm going to quote from an article on the website RS21 here. It was in fact a French business, Schneider, which in 1922 helped to open a plant for the production of toxic shells in Melilla. And indeed, the French made an official request, French general, Liotli, made an official request to his supervisors for provisions of chemical weapons in June 1925, justifying that the use of these munitions with their toxic power allows us to spare human lives during our attacks. Wait. In face of these bombs dropped in the most populated regions of the territories controlled by Abdel Krim, the Rifians tried to fight back with non-explosive projectiles, as well as making shells charged with pepper power, with little success. Right up to the end of the Rif War, the Spanish army would continue to use these lethal gases with the support of the French forces, with Marshal Pétain at their head in Morocco. So, to spare human life, they attack civilian targets with chemical weapons.
They're like, so look, hear me out. I didn't shoot him.
Mm-hmm. I gassed him and his family.
He died from the air.
Yeah, it's some real we had to destroy the village to save it vibes.
Yeah, yeah.
So victory in Morocco started the dictator's time in power off, we're talking about De Rivera here, with widespread popular support. He created a political party, the UP, the Patriotic Union, whose motto was monarchy, fatherland, and religion. His mouthpieces at the UP declared that the De Rivera dictatorship was only a transitional thing, and that the military dictatorship would eventually be replaced with a civil dictatorship. So hey, this military dictatorship, just temporary. We got a civil dictator. It's going to be fine.
It's great.
It's
going to
be a totally reasonable kind of dictatorship.
It's like a dictator without the guns. Like, it's cool. It's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this would be difficult. Yeah. So the Patriotic Union, or the UP, was mostly composed of middle-class conservative Catholic Spaniards. And historian Stanley Payne notes that in some provinces, sectors of the old political elite did join and dominate, but the organization also incorporated ordinary middle-class people who had not previously been politically active. So in spite of the fact that electoral politics didn't exist during De Rivera's dictatorship, it served a purpose of rallying and in some ways activating the middle class as a political entity. The UP's goal was to ensure some form of right-wing dictatorship remained the permanent government of Spain. And much of their support came from their victory in Morocco and their success in, for the first time, igniting widespread nationalism among the Spanish population. The UP held the country's first mass rallies, and for a while, De Rivera and his party were popular. But by 1929, the worldwide economic crash had started to hit Spain as well. The wealthy financiers who'd backed his regime started to sour on him and some of his interventionist economic policies. At the same time, De Rivera faced growing resistance from students, who were a political factor for the first time in Spain due to the fact that the dictatorship had reformed the education system. In his last years in power, Rivera sought to stay dictator by taking a leaf from the book of a man he idolized, Benito Mussolini. And this is the first time De Rivera actually kind of goes fascist a little bit. I'm going to quote from the History of Spanish Fascism here. Italian diplomatic correspondents from Madrid in the final days of 1929 reported that Primo de Rivera was indicating that he would soon begin a fundamental reorganization of the UP along the lines of the Fascist Party. This reorganization never got started. As Javier Tussell and Ismael Saz have written, what the Spanish dictator felt for Mussolini was considerably more than platonic admiration. He was pathetically incapable of transferring Italian institutions to Spain and was often infantile in his effusive expressions to Mussolini. So he wants to be a fascist by this point. And he's like, he's kind of simping on Mussolini here.
On
like
Beanie Moo Moo, yeah.
Yeah, just like, you're so good. I just want to do what you do. Why can't I be as cool as you? it's kind of sad.
My country.
He's an old man, too, at this point. He's not doing great. It is very weird. He's a Mussolini stan hardcore, but he just doesn't have what it takes to be a fascist dictator. He's only a normal dictator, you know?
Yeah.
You hate to see it. In January of 1930, this dictator was shit-canned by his king, who followed him out the door about a year or so later because popular support for the monarchy collapsed as a result of the dictatorship. For a brief, awkward period, Spain lacked any kind of legitimate government. Its king and parliament were gone. A short succession of strongmen held power as the national political elite struggled to cobble together some kind of functional government. The whole experience further radicalized the middle class, this time activating large numbers of Spanish liberals, who advocated in the streets for a republican government. In 1931, the Spanish Republic was born.
Okay.
Now, this did not thrill a lot of people. Like, it thrilled people, a lot of people, but it also kind of pissed off a lot of people, particularly young military officers who'd supported the dictatorship. Francisco Franco was one of these frustrated men. He'd been a close student of Primo de Rivera and had liked his unofficial title of national boss. Like Jefe Nacional or something like that. Jefe Nacional is kind of what they call Primo. And he was like, I like that idea. I like being everybody's boss.
Dope.
Of dictatorship proved to Franco that a strong man could unify Spain, bring law and order and military victory. The only error that De Rivera had made in Franco's mind was that he didn't have any kind of ideology. Franco didn't really believe in anything other than, like, I'm the guy who can fix Spain. And when you don't have that concerted kind of ideology, you can't hold together a dictatorship very long unless you're willing to be brutal. And Primo, you know, he was not a great guy, very brutal in Morocco, but was not willing to be brutal in Spain. Not really. And, not compared to any other dictator, you know?
And Franco was with him in Spain. I mean, was with him in Morocco, right?
Yeah. Franco was like, he was a colonel in Morocco.
Yeah, okay.
And one of the, like, people will say that, like, De Rivera was a bloodless dictator, which, again, looking at what happened in Morocco, not true.
I don't know.
If you're living in Spain, he's not mass executing people. He's not even mass imprisoning people. He's not hosting huge executions of his political enemies. He's a pretty, if you're in Spain, a pretty mild dictator, about as mild as they get this century, you know, which is not to, like, whitewash him or anything. It's just, like, part of why he doesn't stay in power long, you know? You got to be more brutal than he is if you're going to hold power as a dictator. Now, Primo de Rivera's fall from power was also a lesson to Benito Mussolini. It convinced him that his regime could not afford to compromise its power at all with an elected parliament. This was, and Mussolini saw basically like, the only option, I have to become so authoritarian that no one can push me out. And as a result, de Rivera's fall was a major, it pushes Mussolini to spring towards more radical authoritarian policy in 1932. All of this stuff is interconnected, you know, just like everything, just like the Syrian civil war is directly connected to why President Donald Trump became the president, you know? Like, it's all, everything always is connected. That's the way the fucking world works.
Yeah.
The Spanish Republic would have just 5 years of pre-war existence. For its first 2 years, the socialists dominated the government. So not like hardcore communists, but definitely like left wing. First 2 years, the left is dominating the Republic. For the next two, a center-right counter-reformation pushes back against the gains of the left. The tug of war was largely in politics between socialists, Republican centrists, and Catholic conservatives. And the Catholic conservatives, starting in 1933, were represented by Spain's first mass Catholic political party and first really powerful right-wing political party, the CEDA. And I'm even going to try to tell you what it stands for. We'll call them CEDA, you know? That's the birth of like the organized political right in Spain in a way that actually is able to take some power.
Dang.
Now, the CEDA was the primary home for the conservative middle class who'd been radicalized first by Primo de Rivera's dictatorship and next by the early years of left-wing power in the Republic. And they're being radicalized both by the fact that the socialists are in power and they're doing the things socialists do, which is in part to say the church is not going to have power. Like, we're not going to, like, let the Catholic Church run things. But also by the, like, the anarchists who are still fucking up churches and stuff in this period of time. So it's the same it is here. You've got kind of these more moderate people on the left, and then you've got people on the left in the streets doing things that scare these religious conservatives and make them decide, like, we have to take back our country. That happens in Spain too. It's a familiar story again to everyone listening. Now, a number of socialist laws were passed that clamped down on the power and prestige of the church in this period. And obviously, there were, again, widespread, like, there were anarchists attacked 50 convents in Madrid in 1931. And again, this helps energize the right. It's also, if you're a Spanish anarchist who grew up living under a Catholic church that did all of the kind of fucked up shit we know the Catholic Church to do, nobody's, again,
nobody's shedding a tear.
Nobody's a monster here. Well, there are some monsters. We're about to talk about them. But yeah, this enraged fundamentalists, and the CEDA, like, because of how angry they were at the left, the CEDA is never a party that accepts the necessity of democracy, right? They want to take power and institute a Catholic state. They don't believe the Republic that they're participating in is legitimate, which also sounds familiar to a Republic.
The Dominions. The Dominionists.
Now, again, while this is all going on, the radical left in Spain tried several times to carry out insurrections against the Republic. So the anarchists, because they're anarchists, do try to overthrow the Republic because they don't like the Republic either for different reasons than the CEDA. In some cases, they even fought alongside communists. Communists and anarchists are pretty good at working together in this period compared to how they'll be later. They attack police stations. And in 1934, they succeed in taking over large chunks of the state of Asturias. This insurrection got far enough that the Republic called in their imperial shock troops, the Foreign Legion, who brutally suppressed the revolt by massacring basically everybody they could, just gunning people down in huge numbers. The thing, the only thing that they do, you know, that's why you have these guys, to murder everybody.
To put everybody down. Everybody shut up. When I get there, everybody shut up. Everybody sitting down.
We do not have machine guns because we're good at being like, at discriminating with our violence. We have machine guns because it makes it faster, you know?
Sounds like Aunt Stephanie. She just come in and every... I'm not asking who did what or why this is broke. Everybody sit down.
Yeah, it's your aunt who comes in with the fucking sandal and just starts.
Yeah,
hitting.
She like, just starts you all the need chocolate, to calm down. You know what I'm saying? Because we in Spain. So she come in with the chocolate. Yeah. She just everybody getting it. I don't got no, I don't want to hear nothing. Everybody getting it. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? That's my Aunt Stephanie. Yeah. What's up, Aunt Stephanie?
The CNT, who's that anarcho-syndicalist party, launches constant strikes in this period, largely because they're angry that the Republic had failed to re-stid. So when the Republic comes to power, the far left is like, because the far left are anarchists and they're agricultural, right? They're primarily in rural areas. And most of Spain's agricultural land, like 70% or more, is owned by just like rich assholes who make the people who are actually farming it pay them unreasonable rent and it like keeps them impoverished. And the radical left is like, the land should belong to the people who farm it.
Yeah.
Maybe, why don't we do that?
Yeah. I don't understand. We got a lot of radical thoughts. This don't feel radical though.
Yeah. It doesn't, it's not, it isn't the time. It shouldn't be. Yeah.
Yeah. This really shouldn't be a radical thought. They work the land so they should own it. This scene.
The Republic, being a Republic, gave them some of what they want, but not much. They redistribute about 10% of Spain's uncultivated land to the peasants. And that really pisses off the anarchists. So they launch a bunch of, in addition to these insurrections that other anarchists are doing, the CNT is doing like strikes and stuff in this period as protests. In 1933, a peasant protest was suppressed by Republican police who shot 19 of them dead. So this government, which is broadly speaking, we'll call it a liberal government, is a government. They still, you know, gun people down when you fuck up, right? Like,
yeah.
Now, the constant unrest damaged the left's middle class support, and the infighting between communists, anarchists, and Republicans hurt the, broadly speaking, liberal and left ability to keep control of the government from the right. In 1934, the CEDA, led by José María Gil Robles, became the dominant power in government. Or at least gained a lot of power in government. This provoked outrage from the Spanish. Like, they weren't in control or anything, but they had power for the first time. This really pissed off the Spanish left, because in the rest of Europe, at the same time, Hitler has just consolidated all of his power and destroyed Weimar democracy. Italy is completely fascist now. And there's dictators all throughout Europe. So the left sees the CEDA gain some power and they're like, this is the start of what we're seeing happen. The fascists are going to take over. They're not wrong to be terrified that way, because that is what happens, you know?
I was like, it's happening. That's because it's going to happen.
It's happening here, they say.
Yes.
They're not wrong. So again, the left in Spain, and when I say the left in this sense, I mean both like the liberals, the anarchists, the communists, all the socialists, like all of them, start to get really panicked. And this fear is reinforced by the fact that Gil Robles consistently gave speeches ranting against democracy and in favor of what he called a totalitarian concept of the state. Stanley Payne writes, quote, "It seems fairly clear that the CEDA's basic intentions were to win decisive political power through legal means, the exception being an ill-defined emergency situation, and then to enact fundamental revisions to the new Republican Constitution, which restricted Catholic rights, in order to protect religion and property and alter the basic political system." So again, they're not out of line to be afraid of what is going to happen by the CEDA gaining power. Left-wing fears that the CEDA would bring fascism to Spain were further stoked by the fact that CEDA magazines kept running huge, loving articles about how good fascism was. They would have like these huge spreads about fascist Italy and what a perfect state it was. There were articles about the Nazi regime in Germany. Now, broadly speaking, the Spanish far right is more Italian fascist than German. For one thing, they don't really get the anti-Semitism. Like everyone in Europe, they're kind of anti-Semitic, but it's not an organizing principle for them. The Nazis they see is like kind of weird, but like still, you know, they're better than the left. But like
it's like I get what y'all going for. I really don't understand this part.
I'm vibing with you.
We kicked out the Muslims. I mean, I guess it's the same, but I don't know. Anyway, you'll say right.
Yeah. So Robles even visited, the guy in charge of the CEDA, even visited Germany in 1933 to attend the annual Nazi party rally in Nuremberg. So again. The CEDA is not entirely a fascist party, but the left in Spain in this time calls them objectively fascist, and you can see why. Now, for his part, Robles only really rejected fascism because he saw it as foreign. During a speech in 1933, he said, "We want a totalitarian patria, but it is strange that we're invited to look for novelties abroad when we find a unitary and totalitarian policy in our own tradition." So he's like, fascism, like, I like it, but it's foreign, and we in Spain have our own totalitarian tradition that we should be embracing. phrasing. And when he said this, he was actually referencing Ferdinand and Isabella, the first Spanish monarchs, who were not totalitarian. It wasn't, you couldn't be back then. You just,
didn't exist, but yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it's very silly and very ahistorical.
Yeah.
In the same speech, Robles continued, "For us, power must be integral. For the realization of our ideal, we shall not be held back by archaic forms. When the time comes, Parliament will either submit or disappear. Democracy must be a means, not an end. We are going to liquidate the revolution."
Liquidate.
So,
damn.
Yeah. That's in addition to the CDEDA, who, if you don't want to call them fascists, they're at least pretty close.
Hey, fascists, low sodium fascists.
Yeah, low sodium fascists. They're like they're like Diet Mountain Dew. Yeah, fascists, it's like
gluten-free
right?
fascists. You know?
Like you don't want to go all the way, but you're on the spectrum.
Yeah.
Now, Spain also had its own explicitly fascist political parties. And when I don't call the CEDA fascist, it's because I do want to differentiate between the people who are like, we're fascists, you know? Yeah. Like it is important to do that. Yeah. That grew and evolved throughout the early 1930s. Now, the founding father of Spanish fascism was a guy named Ramiro Ledesma Ramos. And like most fascist intellectuals, he wanted to be a novelist before he got into politics. And he wrote a fake memoir of it. It's very Ben Shapiro kind of
Yes,
dude.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. He wrote a fiction novel, which was a fake memoir about a depressed intellectual who commits suicide, which seems like it was very self-pitying. And nobody is willing. He writes it when he's 18. Nobody's willing to take it. And his rich uncle pays to publish it, which tells you all you need to know about Ledesma, the fascist, Spanish fascism. So as a pseudo-intellectual, Ledesma's greatest concern was that Spanish culture had not given the world a truly dominant political ideology. He complained, "We are the only great people who have still not borne the philosophical scepter and who therefore have not projected an intellectual dictatorship over the world." Hmm. And so as a result of this, he decided to steal a political system from Italy and become a fascist. He eventually formed the Juntas de Ofensiva Nacional Sindicalista, or JONS, and his followers are called the JONSistas, which is silly, but
that's
what they're called. Yeah, Ledesma and his fellow JONSistas refused to call themselves fascists, but they were. They talked lovingly of Italian fascism, and they wanted the same things. One of Ledesma's first followers was the first Spanish translator for Hitler's Mein Kampf, but to his credit, Ledesma did try to find ways to make Spanish fascism unique. In part, he attempted to do this by marrying it to Spanish anarcho-syndicalism. Ledesma adopted syndicalism, the idea of worker councils governing themselves and striking to make their demands met, or adopted aspects of that, and he kind of awkwardly welded it to Spanish revolutionary nationalism. And one of the things that is odd that characterizes Spanish fascists in this period is they really reach out to the anarchists. They're trying to convert anarchists, in part because the anarchists are like the most vital anti-government movement in this period.
Yeah. They was reading the tea leaves of being like, you know, I think you don't like the same shit we don't like.
Yeah. Maybe I can convince you to be a fascist.
Yeah.
And it happens for some of them, right? Like that is a story that's very uncomfortable about anarchist history, is that during the period of time when fascism rises, a number of anarchists in different countries and an uncomfortable number of them decide, nah, you know what? I'm a fascist, which is not great.
Yeah, let's just do that.
Yeah. And it's important, you know, whatever you believe, to be honest about its history, and that includes the ugly parts. So Ledesma and his fellow JONSistas refused to call and also we're going to talk in part two about the fact that a fuckload of anarchists died fighting fascism in Spain, and were a lot of the very first people who were willing to put their lives on the line to fight global fascism before the United States was willing to fight the Nazis. A fuckload of anarchists died fighting fascism, and I'm not trying to say that like, and that's much more dominant a part of anarchist history than the ones who went fascist, but a number of them do go fascist, something the fascists directly try to encourage.
It's like the Black Trump.
Exactly.
Look, man, they're still us, dog. That's still, I can't lie. That's my uncle, man.
Yeah, and it doesn't erase the fact that Biden only won the election because of a fuckload of organized Black voters, you know? So, like the left wing of the Nazi Party had done, Ledesma sought to make fascism collectivist, stressing that the individual has died and that the collectivist state is all that matters. This was not an initially successful line of propaganda. And by the end of 1932, there were barely any John Cistas. Spanish fascism might not have taken off at all if it had not been for a fellow named Jose Antonio de Rivera, the son of the now dead dictator. So de Rivera's kid becomes like really the first prominent Spanish fascist. And one of the things, this guy is such a figure in Spanish history that he's one of the only people from this period of Spanish history who's known by his first names. He's Jose Antonio. They don't call, like, they call his dad de Rivera. He's Jose Antonio, which is like kind of a mark of how significant this guy was.
Yeah.
Now, Jose was a weird fascist, and we'll talk more about him in part two. He is not like other, he's not nearly, for one thing, he doesn't really like violence in the same way that a lot of fascists do. Wow. And he's like weirdly friendly with a lot of socialists, like in government, like he's like, and not in a, I don't know. He's a very weird fascist. His background, though, makes complete sense. He's the rich son of a military family whose father took almost absolute power in order to murder foreigners and steal their shit. So it's not weird that he becomes a fascist.
Yeah, he's like, it's like representation matters. Like, you have to see something to believe that it's possible. So he's like, my dad took over the country. I mean, I bet I can, too. Yeah,
and you could see him as like kind of what I'm sure one of the Trump kids will try to do. Although I would argue he's a better person than any of the Trump kids.
Wow.
Not a high bar.
Yeah.
So he creates his own fascist party based on the idea of bringing in another dictator like his dad, but not sucking at it this time. Right. Like, we need a dictator. My dad had the right idea, but he didn't have an ideology. I'm going to bring in an ideology.
Yeah.
And both Jose Antonio's party and the Johncistas receive a shot in the arm on January 30th, 1933, when Hitler takes power in Germany. A magazine, El Fascio, which is a very subtle name.
I'm sorry.
I peaked. My vocal peaked right there. I was El Fascio. They turned to red. El Fascio. God dog it.
So Hitler takes power in Germany and El Fascio gets launched in Spain, and the government shuts that shit down right away and bans publication of future editions.
Which is like, when in doubt, look, you need your brand to be clear.
Yeah.
You need to be clear. So there's
.com.
Trump, and we're talking a lot in the United States now about the value of deplatforming fascists, about the, and I'm an advocate for aspects of that, about the value of taking away these people's ability to reach a mass audience. Mm-hmm. They do a harder, much harder core version of that in Spain. You get in, one of the things that's unique about Spain is the police in this period crack down on the fascists more than they do on the left, which is weird. Mm-hmm. It's unique historically. Everywhere else, it is the opposite.
Yeah.
And part of why is because the Republic is very scared of these fascists for good reason. And if we're looking at like the effectiveness of deplatforming, to what extent it works, Spain shows us that it doesn't necessarily stop them from gaining power, because they deplatform the fascists. They try hard to deplatform the fascists in the Spanish Republic. It doesn't do the trick. So again, useful historical context here, which is not to say there's no value in deplatforming, but we should be paying attention to what happened in Spain. Yeah. And the deplatforming in Spain is being done by the government, you know, by cops and shit. Now, the law for the defense of the Republic gave the Spanish Republic power to ban anything that threatened the Republic's existence. Banning fascist propaganda, though, was not enough to stop the contagious excitement over fascism and the broader right-wing reaction against the recent victories of the left. The Johncistas and Jose Antonio's movement grew. Jose Antonio was noted as not being particularly charismatic, but he was good with words, and he was a successful lawyer, so he had money. He entered into frequent public debates with left-wing intellectuals, where he would say stuff like this. So again, he's a big, like, kind of like Richard Spencer. I will go down and sit down and talk with all of you. I'll be very nice. I'll be very polite, and I'll talk about fascism in that way. He's that kind of fascist.
Okay.
Quote, this is Jose Antonio from a debate he had with kind of a more liberal guy. The liberal state believes in nothing, not even in itself. It watches with folded arms as all sorts of experiments, even those aimed at the destruction of the state itself. Fascism was born to light a faith, neither of the right, which at the bottom aspires to preserve everything, even the unjust, nor of the left, which at the bottom aspires to destroy everything, even the just, but a collective, integral, national faith. And you can see why people would be appealed to us. For one thing, like, we're not right wing, we're not left wing, they're both bad, we're something different. And he also, the thing that all fascists have to do in order to succeed is point out things that are true and problems with the system. And he does. Yeah. The liberal state believes in nothing, not even in itself. You know? That's a good statement.
It's a good, yeah, that's good.
yeah.
Kind of got one there.
Yeah. And that's part of why, again, that's part of why he does succeed in bringing in some people from the left to the fascists and converting people. And at least in getting a lot of them to be like, well, he's not as bad as the state. You know, a lot of people will say that. In July of 19, and a lot of people don't, by the way, anarchists murder we'll talk about this in part two, murder a fuckload of fascists in this period. Yeah. So when I say a number of people on the left are like, well, he's not as bad as the state, a lot of people on the left are like, no, they're bad and we have to start shooting them to death now. Let's not, it's a lot's going on.
You said in the beginning, this is messy. It sure is.
Yeah. In July of 1934, the Johnsistas launched an attack on the Madrid offices of the Friends of the USSR, damaging the offices and threatening people with pistols.
Okay.
This caused a government crackdown, both on the fascists and on the anarchists, arresting some 3,000 people nationwide. Again, like we're probably about to see, this is what the government does. In fairness, like right now, the anarchists are not doing much other than standing outside of buildings and breaking windows. In this, they were gunning people down. So
It's different.
I don't want to like try to make the case that Spanish history is exactly, but like I think there are useful parallels. One of the things, again, Spanish police did arrest more fascists and were more willing to than other members of the left than members of the left at this point. And in fact, the first 2 years of Jose Antonio's movement, anarchists assassinated and gunned down and stabbed a fuckload of fascists in brawls and outside of speeches. Now, Jose Antonio was fairly unique among fascists, both in that he had genuinely warm and respectful relationships with a lot of left-wing politicians, and that he seemed to abhor violence. This was a problem for his young party, and we'll talk about that more in part two. Now, in October of 1934, Jose Antonio traveled to Spain for a brief meeting with Mussolini and to tour a fascist state. He found it inspiring, and he wrote, "Fascism is not just an Italian movement. It is a total, universal sense of life. Italy was the first to apply it, but it is not the concept of the state as an instrument in the service of a permanent historical mission valid outside of Italy. Who can say that such goals are only valuable for Italians?" He returned from Italy eager to make, and so again, the Johnsistas, the other chunk of the fascist movement, are like, we don't want to do Italian fascism because we're Spanish.
We're Spain, yeah.
Jose Antonio's like, no, fascism's a global thing, and it appeals to all of us. And he returns from Spain eager to make a deal with the Johnsistas in order to merge both movements. He recognizes your propaganda's better, I have more people, I'm better at like organizing the street movement. If we work together, we can bring fascism to Spain. In early November, both groups of fascists came to an agreement. They initially wanted to use the name Fascismo Español, but decided to change this to Falange Española, which means Spanish phalanx. The Falanges would, in time, go on to earn a terrible and bloody reputation in Spanish history, but that is going to be in part two. A lot of history in this.
Oh, man, this is dope. One, it's like, for every, I love the, like, for every kid that, you know, either sat next to or was the little stoner kid that was like drawing the anarchist A on their folder in high school, that was just like, no rules. It's like, no, it's a real thing. It's an ideology. It's not just you not getting suspended for, you know, slapping a kid. Like, it's a real thing.
It's a way to organize the world and society and a bunch of different ideas, right? The anarcho-syndicalists have one. There's a lot of different there are also anarchists like anarcho-primitivists and stuff who don't want to who want to go back to a more like it, there's a bunch of shit within anarchism.
But it's not you with your little, drawing your little A on your skateboard, you know, you little shit. Like, I mean, there's more to it.
That's how it starts. And I will say, I've seen a lot of people in Portland do very interesting things with skateboards. A lot of teenage anarchists this year. That's how it starts for some people, you know?
Okay. If that's the entry level, I'll give you that.
It's deeper than that. There's a lot going on, you know?
Yeah, anarchist I'm just like, hey, this doesn't mean that you never have to read again. Chad,
no.
You have to
In
read
fact,
still.
You have to read a lot.
Okay. Like there's a thought, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why I named him Chad. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. That's, yeah. Well, I think we could stand to convert more of the Chads.
Yeah.
Anyway, this has been part one, the birth of Spanish fascism. In part two, we're going to talk about the Spanish Civil War, which is one of the most fascinating and important pieces of history that almost no one knows a goddamn thing about.
And it's frustrating.
It's very frustrating.
It's so frustrating people don't know about this.
No, so many few people know that, like, the author of 1984, George Orwell, traveled to Spain on the premise that every single decent person should kill one fascist, and then killed a bunch of fascists with grenades. George Orwell was incredible with grenades. He knew all the different kinds of grenades. He killed a lot of people with grenades. He got shot in the throat. Like he's.
Oh my God.
Oh man.
I'm gonna give you this as another piece of trivia that has to do with another hip hop trivia. This good Easter egg for your listener. Mm-hmm. And then for you, just, I think you might find this interesting and pull this out one day when you're drinking with friends. Mm-hmm. Ice-T, not the drink, but
the
rapper the actor in Law and Order. Mm-hmm. The guy that made an album called Cop Killer.
Yes.
And became a cop on TV. Yeah. you know, greatest hustle ever. Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's this story he tells that, about when he was getting his record deal. And as the legend goes, he never played one song for the people that signed him for his first record deal, right? And they were like, how are you going to do this? Why would you sign if we haven't heard any music? He goes, hey, if you're selling a box of grenades, if I blow up a grenade, I need to blow up a grenade for you to know that they're good. Like, I can't blow it up because then you won't buy them. They already done. Mm-hmm. And then the guy was like,
the
man, that's
Ice-T thing I've ever
seen. Yeah, so Ice-T. And the guy was like, oh, it's actually a good point. And then he goes, what made you think of that? He goes, well, I used to sell grenades. Ice-T. And I totally believe that. He was running around South Central selling grenades.
I believe
that. I would never call Ice-T a liar for saying that he sold grenades. No. Absolutely not. Yeah. He comes from you've got your eras of gangster rap where they're just talking, and then you've got your era of gangster rap where it's like, no, you did all of the things you're talking about.
this is why you're not in jail. It's because you're rapping.
There was a period of time for you where you were like, it was a good day because I didn't have to use my AK.
These are true stories, y'all. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why most of them didn't make it very long.
Yes.
Oh, man. All right. Well, in preparation for the Spanish Civil War, which is pretty gangster.
Yes.
Listen to some old school Ice-T, you know, and then watch some Law and Order, you know, really embrace the hypocrisy that we all embody at some point.
You don't need to watch the Ice-T and Coco reality show, though.
I am recommending that.
Please don't recommend that.
No, but a little bit of Law and Order, you know, it's whatever.
It's on literally at all times.
Yeah, it's a lot like heroin, you know? It's probably not going to kill you, but it's bad for you.
I've seen every episode of Law & Order SVU. I'm not ashamed at all.
Mm-hmm.
Every episode.
I believe it.
Every episode.
It's on at any given time of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. When my mom was in the hospital, we watched every episode because it was always on. I've seen every episode.
There's a belief in some Aboriginal Australian cultures, and this is kind of where the what is the long tube that they blow
thing that's ever happened.
No, the
didgeridoo
the didgeridoo ties into this, that like you always have to be someone always has to be playing music because you sing the world into being, and if the music stops, the world ends. And I have adopted as a religious belief that with Law and Order SVU, as long as it's playing somewhere, the world can continue.
I think that's how we ended up with Trump, man. So everybody turned off their TV one day, and Law and Order stopped playing.
We have 1 hour without Law and Order, and everything went to shit. All right. Well, this has been part one of our two-parter of Behind the Insurrections on the Spanish fascism and Spanish Civil War. We'll talk about Spanish Civil War in part two, and then next week we're going to talk about the fascists who failed, and we're going to give a little overview of some anti-fascist history you might not know. We're going to close out with Antifa and some fun stuff, like the Eidelvis Pirates, which were little kids who murdered Nazis. It was great. Fucking rad.
All right. Rad.
Here we go. Listen to some Ice-T.
That's the episode.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone in our country has a voice. It's something that says not just where you come from, but who you are. Welcome to NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of podcasts and a celebration of the hosts in journalism who've always spoken truth to power. Our voices are as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, and stories should never be about us without us. Find NPR Black Stories, Black Truths on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, starting May 6th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.